you're on the front porch where we tackle the tough issues facing Appalachia like you and your friends do on your front porch. So the big news this week is that it appears, at least for now, that the Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare may be dead. And West Virginia Senator Shelley Mercapito had a not insignificant role in this thing. Is it really dead? And if so, what does that mean for West Virginia? We'll discuss. And then we'll talk about dream hoarders. This is a new book about whether the upper middle class in America is trying to keep the American dream to itself and prevent other people from being able to access it. And we're going to talk about the upper middle class here in West Virginia. And yes, there is one. The Front Porch is sponsored by the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather alerts, download the CGM app at iTunes or Google Play. I'm Scott Finn, CEO of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and we're joined, as always, by lawyer and conservative columnist Lori Lynn. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
And liberal columnist Rick Wilson, who works for the American Friends Service Committee. Hey.
Hi, Scott.
All right, let's get to it. It appears that the Republican efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare have, at the very least, taken a very bad turn for now. And there's some people in the media that are proclaiming the whole effort dead. Let's start with that, guys. Do you think this is done, or do you think that it'll come back like the House bill came back?
I think it's like the end of a round, not the end of a fight. But it is significant. Oh, I want to give a shout out to Senator Shelley Mercapito. I think she really listened to her constituents about what eliminating Medicaid expansion, opioid treatment, and structurally really cutting back Medicaid would do to this state. So, you know, give her props for that.
And she said, you know, I didn't come here to hurt people, when she and two other Republican Senate women banded together to say they wouldn't vote for the straight repeal without having a replace plan. So the former Republican Attorney General in Virginia, Ken Cuccinelli, was on NPR this morning, and he is going to be leading a PAC that is devoted in part to defeating the moderate opponents of the Obamacare repeal. What do you think the political repercussions will be for Senator Capito for expressing some reservations about this bill that ended up dying?
There will be people who are angry about it. Is this going to affect her when she's up for reelection in 2020? I kind of doubt it. She's really savvy. I don't think this is going to be the issue that, you know, does her in any way.
Repercussions for her? I don't see her suffering a lot from the right in any this election cycle or too many others. Repercussions might happen in Washington, but I don't think they're going to happen to her in West Virginia.
But Rick is being very complimentary and nice to her. Now, you did see yesterday on Twitter, there were some people saying, well, you know, notice she only came out against it after it was already dead. And she did that really for the second time. You know, once it's already clear that it's not going to pass, then she says, well, I don't support it. Very politically shrewd. You can't fault her for that. But you do see some voices on the left now that it's pretty much clearly dead. They're not sucking up to her as much anymore. They're saying, oh, well, you know, it's not exactly profiling courage what she did.
I have on a few occasions said complimentary or thank you things to or about Senator Capito. And I have had some people say, why are you giving her a shout out, or why do this? And I'm sorry, politeness matters. Being courteous matters. When someone does something nice, whether you agree with them or everything else, you say thank you. You call the point. This is one of the big rants. And I think that should be a norm of our culture.
What about the Republicans' ability over the next 18 months to get their agenda through? A lot of pundits are saying, oh, it's all over. They can't do anything. McConnell has gone from being the Svengali of the Senate to, you know, a dope.
Yeah, well, people also say the Washington is littered with the bodies of people who underestimated Mitch McConnell. The problem was that there were some things that were built on, that were predicated on them being able to pass a health care bill and get the savings from it. Essentially, tax cuts were going to be the next step, and they needed that money coming out of health care to do the tax reform. So that gets a lot harder to do. And then just the general atmosphere of carnival, clown show, Trump stuff. You don't know where the Russia thing is going to go. That sucks up all the oxygen really quickly once that gets really going, if it does.
Senator Capito has been criticized for voting for repeal as recently as 2015, voting for repeal and now not being willing to vote for it. Of course, the circumstances are different. They all knew that Obama would veto it. Her spokeswoman said it was a symbolic vote to get Obama's attention. But now that the rubber's hitting the road, she wants to see. She's been very consistent. You know, we feel like Groundhog Day here on healthcare because we've been talking about this over and over. But she herself on the front porch was saying, I want to see a bill before I vote for a repeal. I want the bill to protect people with pre-existing conditions. She's been pretty consistent in her feelings about this thing. So, Rick, what happens next? Let's say that there is no repeal. Obamacare is still the law of the land, but it has some health issues of its own. Where does the policy fight go for you and for the other liberals?
Well, for one thing, that failure of the bill is like the story of the dog that chased the car and then caught it and like didn't know what to do with it. You know,
the Republicans are the dog.
A bit, yeah. Just an analogy. There really are problems with the Affordable Care Act that really need to be fixed, especially in the individual marketplace. I mean, we interviewed a bunch of people who receive health care from Cabin Creek, and everyone says, you know, for God's sake, don't take it away. But some people really do have problems with paying premiums and copays and all that. It would be nice in a rational world if they would actually address the big problems in a bipartisan way. But it could be like the old Saturday Night Live skits where they think, why don't we do this? Nah. So, I mean, that'd be the best outcome, I think.
You know, and let me just beat my drum one last time on healthcare costs. Sarah Klein is a reporter for Vox, who does a lot of great healthcare reporting. And she had a story out just a couple weeks ago about how much more expensive every procedure is in America than anywhere else in the world. Here's a great example, an MRI. An MRI in America will cost you twice what it costs in Switzerland and five times what it costs in Australia. And Switzerland, by the way, is the most expensive healthcare country in the world outside of America. We're twice as expensive as the most expensive country for the exact same procedure.
And actually, the cost of MRI could vary from place to place in this country and just going across town.
I mean, and Obamacare did nothing really. There were some provisions, experiments, they call them, to try to deal with cost containment. And there's an argument about how effective they were, but really didn't do enough to bend the curve.
And can I recommend a book if you really want to go there? I'm reading it now called American Sickness by Elizabeth Rosenthal, who's actually a physician who studies all the things that are screwed up about the American healthcare system, and it truly is overdetermined. And there are a lot of really powerful interest groups in here. Yeah, absolutely. This is what I would like to have this discussion and really get on practical things here.
Maybe we could bring in somebody. Hey, if you're listening to The Front Porch and you know about healthcare spending and you want to have an honest conversation about it, let us know.
Everyone should Google this article. I cannot remember the publication it was in. It was somebody who was going in for a colonoscopy, and he had a choice whether he was going to be sedated or not. He wanted to know what was it going to cost to be sedated, which sounds like it should be a pretty easy question. No one could tell him. Mm-hmm. The doctors, the hospital, no one could give him any clue whatsoever what it was going to cost him to be sedated. That lack of transparency is a huge problem. If we required hospitals to post prices for things, of course they can't do that because nobody pays the same price. It all depends on what your situation is. So that's part of the problem. But there are two ways to do it. You can come in and set prices and say, this is what an MRI is going to cost. This is what the government says. Or you can do it through the market. And part of that is transparency. So, you know, it's way you want to go.
We have the worst of both worlds, really, when it comes to that.
We have decades of weirdness about healthcare in this country. So, I mean, it's...
You know, I have a personal situation. It's not life-threatening, but it's embarrassing for someone on the radio. I will occasionally involuntarily whistle because I have a missing tooth. And I mean, I'm going on just
fine. I've
never
noticed this.
But about once a week, I'm talking to my family and all of a sudden it's like, shh. You know, I just loud. I can't whistle, but involuntarily I can whistle really loud. And they'll just crack out laughing, you know, and it's really hurting my mental health. But I can't afford right now to get it done in America. Should I go to like Tijuana? I mean, you see these things.
So you just need like a
dental implant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do I trust it? It would be cheaper. I mean, I've looked at it. It'd be a lot cheaper.
People have done things like that.
Right, to fly to Mexico and have someone put it in. Of course, I don't know how I get follow-up treatment and all that stuff. Let me know. Should I go to Tijuana for my teeth?
So could Whistle While We Work be our musical theme when we go out? Can we do that?
And we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the upper middle class in West Virginia there is one, and are they hoarding the American dream? But first, I have a question for you guys about maintaining friendships. We have just concluded a really successful Protect WVPB campaign where we wanted to raise $500,000. We raised $600,000. So you all helped us get that far and farther, and we gained an additional 1,500 members that we didn't have before.
It was sheer terror at losing access to the front porch that probably put you over the top.
You know, right? I gotta say, we did a member survey and the front porch spontaneously popped up in 3 or 4 of the comments. So
3 or 4, wow.
Out of 1,200.
Okay, but, next subject, sorry.
You know, my mom was busy.
Mine's dead.
But how do we make sure that they feel appreciated and that we keep people, you know, happy? Do you have any ideas?
Well, giving them shout outs like we're doing right now is one great thing.
This is so meta.
Reading reader comments on the air, that kind of engagement.
You're really on it with Facebook too. I mean, you really respond to comments.
Yeah, that's another really nice way. People feel like they're part of the conversation. They can kind of easily slip into that.
And maybe a live event. We've threatened to have a live
Facebook,
a live front porch event before.
An actual front porch.
A front porch on the front porch. I'm waiting now for summer to get over.
Yeah, it's too hot right now. Yeah.
Maybe in the fall. Meanwhile, thank you if you are a member. And if you're not yet, it's so easy to make it right. Go to wvpublic.org, click the donate button, and tell them you're doing it because of Lori, Rick, and the front porch. Thanks. All right, we're back, and we're going to talk about class in West Virginia. In particular, Lori, this is not something I think that we discuss much in West Virginia openly, right, Rick? I mean, and yet...
That's changed over time, by the way.
That we used to talk about it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The unions, right? Class consciousness and everything, mm-hmm. Turn of the century. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Lori, you've been fascinated by this new book that goes into this on a national level and want to talk about how we can localize the discussion. So what have you been reading and why is it so interesting to you?
Well, the book is by Richard Reeves. It's called Dream Hoarders. And he focuses on the top 20% of income households in the country. And his thesis is that those people are hoarding the American dream by keeping everyone else out. And the way that they do that, he talks about restrictive zoning, education.
Yeah.
This class of people is really focused on educational attainment, spending a lot of money on their kids' education, putting a lot of effort into, for example, the college admissions process. And his claim is that that is making us less class mobile and kind of locking people in place in a way that hasn't happened before.
And by the way, let's just posit that it is true that there's less social mobility in America today than there was in the recent past, and less social mobility in America than many other industrialized countries.
Like there's more in Europe, many countries in Europe now than there is in the United States. That's a big switch.
So it is a problem.
David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, picked up on this and actually he had a twist on it, which is that it's not really the economic things that are keeping people out. It's these little class signifiers, these little ways of speaking, things that you eat, little almost invisible barriers that keep people out. And he told this really obnoxious anecdote of taking a friend with only a high school education into a sandwich shop, and she didn't know what any of these weird Italian words meant and got super uncomfortable. And so they, you know, left and had Mexican, which she, as a parole, could understand Mexican food.
And we talked about this because it's like, wouldn't a normal non-robot, like, just help them order the food and say, isn't this weird Italian stuff? But what it really means is ham, and you want a ham sandwich.
Yeah, really.
I mean, come on, David Brooks, loosen up a little bit, but okay. So there are two parts to this, I guess you're saying. There's an economic argument. Richard Reeves is coming from more of the center-left sort of the American dream is not available because it's an economic issue. And David Brooks is saying it's more cultural. Well, and so, Lori, what do you think? And how do you think it plays out in West Virginia?
Well, you know, here in West Virginia, we talk a lot on the front porch about lower-income people and problems that they have because they have more problems, right? We don't talk a whole lot about the upper middle class. So I was going to quiz you guys because I looked this up. Where do you think the income threshold is to be in that top 20% here in West Virginia? So if you make above X, household income, you're in the top. And it's lower than the national figure.
I'd say it's way lower here. It's probably around 100.
Yeah, that sounds pretty close to me. Let's say 100.
And one.
$100,001.
That's the way you do it.
You guys are close nationally. And in the U.S., if you make above 100, and if your household makes above $106,000, you're in that 80th percentile, the top 20%. In West Virginia, it's quite a bit lower. It's $82,000.
Wow.
So if you're above that, you are certainly the upper middle class here.
So I think there are a lot of people that are above that would not see themselves as upper middle class.
I think that's right.
West Virginia's ruling class doesn't live in West Virginia for the most part. I mean, their viceroys might, but in general, you know, the people who own a lot of the resources here live out of state, and those who've benefited most by what's happened here do. So
I will say, from a fundraising perspective, it is absolutely true that we have fewer per capita extremely wealthy people here, like the top 0.1%.
Top 5% here in West Virginia, you have to make $142,000. That's lower than what a first-year associate makes at a Washington law firm, for example.
And one of the things I always hear is that, you make less, but it costs less to live here. But we've done the research on this, too. It doesn't cost that much less to live here. I mean, housing is cheaper, but a lot of other things, including food, insurance, just as expensive, if not more so, than other places.
But to Rick's point about people living outside the state, that may be true, or, we don't have to get into that, because the question is really competing with those people, for example, with your kids' school, right? So if they're not living here, it's not relevant what their house looks like because it's not here in Charleston. So talk about the universe of people who actually live here, who are sending their kids to school, who are competing to get into West Virginia University, buying real estate across the road from you, driving a car, shopping in your supermarket. It's that universe of people. And it's interesting to look at the map of, income. There's a great chart I found when I was researching this about the most, you can look and actually see the most unequal counties in West Virginia. Interestingly, the most unequal county where income is least evenly distributed is Monongalia County. And we know what's there. That's also the most educated county in West Virginia.
I imagine a lot of that's students, though, right?
And professors.
I would guess, too, that Kanawha County might be high in that inequality
list.
It
is pretty high. And another county that's quite high
Panhandle.
Is McDowell County, which is also the lowest income county because, it works out in different ways.
Well, if you're middle class in McDowell County, you're in that top. I mean, if you're making $50,000 a year and have a steady income in McDowell County, you're the top 20%. The upper middle class in West Virginia are a little different. And in many different ways than the upper middle class in other places. Not only do they make less, but also they have different attitudes toward the environment. This was a study that Celinda Lake did, I think it's like 10 years ago, Rick. It was a survey of environmental attitudes in West Virginia. In most places in the country, the more income you have as a family, the higher your income, the more liberal your environmental beliefs are. And in West Virginia, it's exactly the opposite. The lower income people have the most liberal environmental beliefs. And then the higher you go, the more conservative environmental belief you have. And of course, that makes sense.
Who benefits?
Well,
did you say qui bono? Is that the Latin for that?
Right. And poor people might not be getting the benefits of, let's say, coal mining in their community.
And they're drinking crappy water and everything else.
And then on the other hand, the middle class people in places like Charleston and Beckley, a lot of them owe their jobs and their security to, the coal mining industry in a lot of direct and indirect ways. So there's one way that we're different from the rest of the country.
Another thing I would say is one of the class markers, overt religiosity, tends on a national level to be something that the more upper class does not display so much. They may be religious, but they don't really talk about it very much. And I would say here, it's not as that is not as much of a class divider. I think the 20%, maybe a little bit less, but certainly I know people here who make quite a bit of money and are also very religious and very open about how religious they are.
One difference about West Virginia compared to, let's say, Florida, where I lived, is that even if you're in this upper middle class, you're always closer to people that make less money than you.
Yeah.
You're less distance from poverty even. But I think, a lot of the resentment people in West Virginia feel toward poor people is a function of fear. this could happen to me. Even in the upper middle class, it's really easy to fall out. There's a lot that you have to do to stay there. And the idea that you could fall down into the lower classes or even be poor is ever present. You're reminded of it every day. The resentment of people who get free medical cards or who get free phones, it's deep. Rick, you get the last word about class, because this is a big deal to you. I know it's not just Lori. You think about this a lot too.
I mean, I could recite some really radical labor songs, but I'd be outing myself. So I have a quote from a French writer instead. I'm going to dial it down a little bit. Anatole France, is that how you pronounce the name?
I'm not sure.
Just to say it with confidence.
Sure. Okay, Anatole France says, "The law in its majestic equality forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread." Bottom line is, I think class is about more objective things than what kind of foo-foo sandwich you order.
And that's the Front Porch for this week. I'm Scott Finn, CEO of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, with Rick Wilson and Lori Lynn. Thanks for listening.